your businesses, and our community. As you know, each year, WCA's working groups develop a state advocacy agenda that we share with the public and our legislators, highlighting our key priority areas. Last year, our advocacy efforts helped to facilitate the first meaningful increases in the Medicaid reimbursement rates in more than a decade. And this year, we hope to get even closer on closing that gap. In addition to other proposals focused on statewide solutions to address local zoning and land use barriers, as well as housing reform and other important issues. We cannot do this alone, and we are so thankful that our Westchester and Putnam state delegation is willing to listen and partner with us to make an impact. We appreciate you all accepting this invitation today, and year after year, we're so thankful that we can have an open dialogue, and we're also very appreciative of what you have all done for our community to make it a better place to live, work, and raise a family. I would like to thank our host sponsor, RPW Group, and its CEO and Chairman, Robert Weiss, and his son, who is the president, Andrew Weiss, for supporting this important forum and hosting us here in their beautiful building today. Robert is a historical longstanding board member. He gave up his seat to his son a few years ago. And Andrew, I know, couldn't be here, but we're so thankful to have Andrew as part of our board and our executive committee. And he's making quite an impact with us as well, with inviting in a new generation of leaders through his leadership group and efforts. I would now like to invite Robert to the stage to welcome you as well and say a few words. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Thank you, Susan and Michael, for the outstanding job you're doing on behalf of the business community in Westchester County. The WCA is certainly a bright light, not only in the county, but throughout the state. So thank you for all the good work you do. And welcome all of you to 1133 on behalf of the RPW staff, on behalf of my boss, Andrew, and myself. Unfortunately, he's under the weather. He couldn't make it here. He was really excited to come, but he couldn't make it. So we are very pleased to have you here and to have the Albany delegation, especially here at 1133. I figure I'll just share a little bit of good news to you today. Today is Groundhog Day, and the prediction is that we're going to have spring very soon. So that's good news. What is not so good news is they're usually right 40% of the time. So let's take it with a grain of salt. But anyway, I think that we are very anxious to hear a very interesting conversation. There are plenty of issues that the Albany delegation needs to deal with, immigration and many others. We know that we are represented by wonderful, very capable people. So welcome all of you. Thank you for being here. Let's have a great meeting.
Lisa Morello, and I'm a partner at Park Strategies. Welcome, everyone. Happy to have you at the WCA Legislators Forum. This is the second year that I have been here, and it's a fabulous forum, really with a fabulous exchange of ideas. So thank you, Michael, for the opportunity to address this crowd and to truly introduce our distinguished guests from the Westchester delegation. As you already know, your delegation is a seasoned and formidable group. They boast leaders, chairs of committees, all dedicated public servants. In Albany, we see firsthand their dedication to the region that they serve, and certainly to issues facing the New York State policy agenda throughout. I'll let Senator Mayer join us. I have the privilege of announcing this distinguished panel, so I will do so. I'll let Shelley make her way in. First and foremost, the Majority Leader, Andrea Stewart-Cousins. Senator Natalia Fernandez. Senator Shelley Mayer. Member of Assembly Gary Pretlow. Member of Assembly Stephen Otis. Member of Assembly Chris Burdick. Member of Assembly Matthew Slater. And Member of Assembly Dana Levenberg. Thank you all. We look forward to a robust discussion.
Thank you, Lisa. I hope we didn't miss anybody on the podium, did we? Okay, good. Also, thanks to Bulging Manufacturing and the Dobner family for also sponsoring, and of course, Rand Commercial, Paul Lather. Paul, where are you? Raise your hand. Thank you, Paul, for sponsoring today. A couple of quick shout-outs to some formerly elected officials who have joined us today. Noam Bramson is here. Noam, where are you? Former State Senators, David Carlucci, and Nick Spano, also Dean Horace Anderson from Pace Law, who was never elected to anything, but I just like when he shows up for events, so thanks for coming. Are there any staffers here? The staffers, please raise your hand. A big round of applause for the staffers. They're the ones who made this work. Former Hill staffer myself, so. So quickly about the way this is going to work today, we have solicited feedback from our members and the community at large about the issues that are most important to them. I have curated some comments that will lead to a discussion, hopefully lively, between the members and the senators. Shocker, they don't always agree on everything, but that's okay. And frankly, that makes for a constructive and lively dialogue. So we're going to start with just some opening remarks from the, on behalf of the delegation, by Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins and Member Pretlow, and then we'll get right into the format. Thank you.
Good morning. Come on, we need some energy here. Yes. So, anyway, it is great to be here. I remember being here last year, and it was the first time we've been back in a very long time after COVID. And what your chair was saying, Susan was saying, about the importance of this gathering, the importance of our hearing from you, the importance of your advocacy, because indeed, it did help us as a delegation to shape not only the conversation, but the outcomes. And yes, there was a historic increase in Medicaid reimbursement. Yes, we heard you in terms of housing compact and how people were feeling about not necessarily building housing, but the way the compact was rolled out and its impact on our community. And yes, we tackled, and we were really so proud as a delegation to tackle finally the education inequities in foundation aid and the amount that had been due our school districts all across the state for well over 30 years, bringing a historic amount of money, fully funding foundation aid, and creating what we thought was a path forward so that we could continue to have our competitive edge. We worked on obviously building our economy and building the workforce, whether it was in our hospitals, we've started tackling our mental health issues by, again, infusing $1 billion into dealing with what we know was an exacerbated problem after COVID. So we as a delegation have worked together. We have been united in not only representing the interests of Westchester, but we also believe, because Westchester is such an incredibly diverse county, it is really an amalgam of the entire state in many ways. When we do it right here, we do it right for the state. We were on a Zoom collectively last night with the education community, some of the education community, and obviously they're understandably concerned about half of the school districts being cut. And we, as a delegation, you will hear over and over again, will be at the forefront of fighting to make sure that, again, when we fix the formula, we fix the entire formula, not just little pieces. If we want to take a look, again, I think it's very similar to the housing. There has to be a comprehensive look. How do we do this right? But again, we will be together now. We will be together with municipal officials after this and on and on. And what is that saying? It's saying that Westchester as a whole is a vibrant community, that all of you are concerned about helping us do our jobs. So as we begin this conversation, I want to say to you that we are so grateful that we have this incredible community. I want to thank you, Mike, for doing this. Amy, Rob, I always love being in your buildings. Lots going on in the area, but thank you so much. And thank all of you for your continued investment in making sure that Westchester continues to lead. Thanks so much.
Good morning, everyone. Our majority leader gave such great opening remarks. I have nothing to add to that. So this, as we said earlier, is going to be a conversation. So we're really here to listen to you and respond to your requests. You have me until 11:30 today because, as the Senator said, we have another meeting with municipal officials in White Plains at 12 o'clock. And I'm not going to go back down to Mount Vernon and drive back up here, so I'm probably going to hang out. Bob, if your office is available, I will sit there and make phone calls if you don't mind. And it is great being in this building. And, you know, many of you don't know that I've known Mr. Weiss since he came to Mount Vernon. I don't know if you know how he started with an old dilapidated school on First Avenue in Mount Vernon and flipped that and turned in and got a movie theater and changed that and now look at it again. The Taj Mahal, the beautiful buildings like this. Tenacity, that's what it is. So congratulations on all that you have done and what you do for Westchester. I think people, Shirley, you know, she's not here. Amy. Oh, okay, because I was pretty sure that Amy was going to get the bulk of the questions as the new head of our health committee. If you have any questions on gambling, gaming, craps, I'm your man. Anything else, the smart people to my left and my right can answer those questions. Okay, so let's get the conversation started.
Thank you, Leader Cousins and Member Preller. I think we're going to start with a topic that doesn't come up quite often at these sorts of events, but is incredibly topical right now, and that is the issue of congressional redistricting. Over the past several years, this is an issue that's been thrown back and forth between the Independent Commission, the courts, and the legislature, and businesses and residents of the county are seeking clarity. The Independent Redistricting Commission will soon release its plan on New York's U.S. congressional lines. The plan thereafter is submitted to the legislature for approval. Ultimately, it is the legislature that has the power to decide and potentially craft its own map. The WCA has circulated a letter advocating for representation which fundamentally supports the rights of and the interests of the county rather than New York City and its outer boroughs. Now, some of you actually share districts that kind of carve out Westchester and also other counties as well. But I'm wondering if any of you would be willing to share your thoughts on congressional redistricting, whether you believe the current line should be modified in Westchester, and if so, how?
Well, you're saying, well, I'll jump in.
Yeah, you got it.
The current lines in Westchester, if they're adjusted, I think almost the entire county is in the 16th, and a small piece is in the 17th district. I don't know how we change the lines much from where they are, because when the congressional lines are drawn, they have to be exact to the person. When you do the assembly lines, we take the average of the state, which is 100, and then divide it by 150, and then you have plus or minus, I think it's 5% for our district. But with the congressional seats, it has to be to the person. So every congressional district has the exact same number of people, plus or minus one person. You start out on Long Island and you work your way through Long Island into Queens, to Brooklyn, Staten Island, Manhattan, Bronx, and Westchester. Everything is pushed up. You say that, I use German, the scheiße goes up. You know, so.
Now, I'm just wondering, it's the courts that have drawn the current map.
Well, we don't want the courts to draw the maps. The Constitution says the legislature should draw the maps. And what was drawn the first time, I believe, was fair. And the courts said they weren't. They redrew the maps, and then it went to the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals said that the Redistricting Commission, which I don't think we should have done, but that's my own personal feeling. I think it was a mistake that we gave away power to those people, but anyway, they're all friends of ours, so I'm going to get into it.
Anyone else?
I think it's, thank you. I'm using my teacher voice. Whatever we think really doesn't matter, because the Independent Redistricting Commission is going to draw the lines. And we will have an opportunity in the legislature to either accept what they've drawn, or if we have a two-thirds majority, to be able to draw our own lines and put that forward, which is what we did last time. And I always want to remind everyone that we did exactly what we were supposed to do the last time. The problem when we put the constitutional amendment, and again, this was a former leadership, former governor, when the constitutional amendment asking whether or not we wanted an independent redistricting commission was put forward, there was nothing in the amendment that would indicate what happens if indeed the independent redistricting commission didn't do their part. They were supposed to present us a map, and if we didn't take that, they were supposed to present us a second map. They presented us a first map. They never presented a second map. And the speaker, myself, members realized that this void existed, so we passed legislation that was signed by the governor that said, should the Independent Redistricting Commission not give their second map or somehow default on whatever they were supposed to do, we, with our two-thirds vote, would be able to pass maps. And that was the law. Where we got into the problem was the lawsuit, and again, lower courts agreed that we had the opportunity to make our maps, but the highest court at that time said that we did not. And that is why we are in the position now of various lawsuits, and now because it has now been resolved that the Independent Redistricting Commission can now come back with a second iteration. So, like I said, our opinion about what's supposed to happen or not is going to be clear at the end of a month. We lost a member, Dr. Flatow, who was a really very, very respected leader on the commission. He was one of my appointees, so I have replaced with Dennis Wolcott, who, again, is a very, very respected person who knows how to do this stuff. So in another month and a half, we will have an opportunity to get, hopefully, our lines done so that wherever people are running, You know, they'll know where they're running, and of course, our responsibility is to vote.
Matt does not caucus with anyone else on the dais. I'm wondering if he has a different perspective.
Thank you, everybody. It's great to be here. I guess I'm the voice that balance out the conversation. I think the lines as they stand are fair. They were drawn by a special master. I think the fact that we continue to see these lawsuits and the process go back and forth has confused voters immensely. They don't know what we're talking about half the time when it comes to redistricting. But what I see when we saw the special master come out with the lines that we currently have are competitive seats, competitive elections. And I think the result of those competitive elections, as we saw, we stand. And I think that they should stand, and those lines should stand. Because again, I don't think that we want to see gerrymandering occur across New York State, especially here in Westchester County. And so we saw the IRC work, yes, questionable about their product, but at the end of the day, when you see a special master, a completely independent person come through and scientifically put maps together that end gerrymandering for the most part and allow for competitive elections, I think that's a good thing for democracy. I think that's a good thing for the Hudson Valley and New York State. So I'd like to see them stand, and hopefully we can stop the ping pong match going back and forth about whether or not we need to continue to sue and confuse voters more than they already are.
So a quick follow-up for the members of the panel. The IRC, which was put in place by a constitutional amendment 10 years ago, was supposed to bring some procedural clarity. Has it worked? Or are additional changes necessary for the process? I just want a show of hands. How many people think that this is going to end up back in the courts? Out there. One person, two people. Look, personally, I think it's going to end up back in the courts. Because, not to draw the lines, I think the lines will get drawn, but somebody's going to be dissatisfied. So we're going to end up back in the courts probably in 3 or 4 months.
And that has always been the case. No matter when, we just make somebody sues. So this isn't unusual. And whether or not it was, again, people want, when Matt talked about gerrymandering, I think everybody knows across the country, gerrymandering has very clearly been the rule of the land. So I think everybody wants to make sure that the voters are picking their officials and the officials aren't picking their votes. I think that, and of course, again, the Independent Redistricting Commission was to create that environment. As I said, the constitutional amendment was not complete, which left, again, the question out there, what happens if they don't do what they do? And they didn't do what they were supposed to do, and so that's why we are here today. So, like I said, I think independent redistricting is the way people have felt. Collectively, we should go. It will go back to court, maybe. But again, our opinions don't matter. We are in the process, and when we get our lines, we will do what we have to do. We either accept them, reject them. We will do what we're supposed to do.
So I'm happy to address this as well. Two things. One is that we need to bear in mind that the reason why the Independent Redistricting Commission has it now is because, as the majority leader has explained, it was the process that wasn't followed. It wasn't necessarily, in fact, it wasn't at all that the Court of Appeals said, these are bad lines. Instead, what the Court of Appeals said was, you didn't follow the process. So it got put back to the Independent Redistricting Commission. Now, this has happened before, because the Independent Redistricting Commission last year had to consider the assembly lines. And as it turned out, they only tweaked a little bit the lines that they had. Now, it can still be challenged in court, but it's been almost a year and it has not been. Those are the lines that those of us up here running for re-election are going to be running on. So I'm not convinced that it'll be back in court. It may be. As to your question about the Independent Redistricting Commission itself, I think the concept of having an Independent Redistricting Commission is very sound, because that's a way in which you have Republicans and Democrats, balanced number, they get to discuss it and come up with something. And that, it's not going to totally eliminate the chances of gerrymandering, but I think it will minimize it. And that's why I can very much support the concept of an IRC.
Thanks, Chris. I'm going to move on because it's Groundhog Day, so we're going to talk about housing again. I still don't know how Bill Murray ended up with editing down in the movie, by the way. It's crazy. But for years, the WCA has advocated for a statewide fix to the housing crisis, the need for statewide legislation, really addressing what we think is the root cause, which is local land use and zoning restrictions that continue to be a serious impediment to building the housing we need. A quick shout out to my partners on the Welcome Home Westchester campaign, Tim Foley and Jan Fisher were here. There are others who are also involved, and we're running symposiums, workshops. We're advocating collaboratively, collectively, so that this panel could hear from one voice many different areas rather than many different voices on the same issue. I understand that Senator Mayer has to run soon. And thank you, Shelley, for showing up. I understand you're also not feeling very well, so thank you for turning out for us. So I'm going to jump around a little bit on my notes and talk about the nexus between building new housing and what we often hear a local refrain on what that's going to do to our school systems, how it's going to overtax our schools, class sizes are going to balloon up, less money will be spent on our students. Shelley is the chairperson of the education committee, so she probably has some specific insight on this. And our studies show, and studies also performed by Pattern for Progress and others conclude, that that's not necessarily the case in Westchester, that school enrollment is actually declining, and that new housing actually increases school taxes per student. You may have a particularly unique perspective sitting on both sides of this issue, the school side, and understanding a lot about housing, so I'm wondering if you'd like to weigh in.
Thank you very much, and apologies for being late. We had an education budget hearing yesterday, went for 12 hours, so I stayed in Albany. Then we had another Zoom, as the leader said. So, first place, I think, just about education, we should clarify that at least half the districts in Westchester, under the governor's proposal, would have an actual cut from last year's funding to this year, under the proposal she's made. And as the leader said, we strongly oppose a number of the things she's done in education. I think it's relevant, we just have to say that. Also, she eliminated the Safe Harmless provision, which had been around since the 70s, which meant even if you had a slight decline in enrollment, you weren't gonna get less than you got the year before. She changed the inflationary factor, and I know all the people in business will appreciate that she took a 10-year rolling average as opposed to the CPI, which certainly lowered the rate of inflation in the foundation aid. The bottom line is that school districts, school boards, PTAs, communities are really up in arms over the extent of this cut and reduction, which was not anticipated, not explained, and we're not in a recession, I'm happy to say. There didn't seem to be any reason for this sort of attrition-style budget. That being said, on the issue of migrants, the real challenge for the education system is in the city of New York, where they have so many additional new students. And if we focus not on the politics of migrants, but on the obligation of the school districts to educate every child that shows up at the door, that is the beauty of our public school system, there is a tremendous cost and obligation of the city of New York school districts to really stand up and meet that challenge. And it's difficult for them, and I'm disappointed the governor did not put more money in their education budget for that. But outside of New York City, including here, you know, credit to George Latimer, the three places where our migrant community is living in our motels in Westchester, none of which have had any serious issues at all, except that we're trying to get services to them. They have not generally been in the school district. The children are below school age, below four. There may be some that get to be four and enroll in schools. We have not seen this issue that has sort of became a political football yesterday at the hearing and elsewhere. Our issue is not new people coming into our school district. If you live in Yonkers or Portchester or all the places where we have new immigrants, we've embraced them and accepted them and found a way to pay for them, including leaning on the state to give us more money. But The migrant issue in the school district, I think, is outside of New York City, is a bit of a red herring, and our challenge is to have our schools be funded adequately for every kid, to keep our teachers and the services, and to make sure that post-COVID, our school districts meet the challenge of bringing kids back into social and emotional health and to reverse learning loss. That costs money, and we honestly, the migrant issue, just so you know, I have a bill and we're pushing to have on IDAs a representative of a school district sit on the board of an IDA as a matter of state law so that they are part of the conversation about development, not to be adverse to it, but to be a party at the table. I think they need to be parties at the table. There's impact with development, but we are not to be scared of development. We just need to have the conversation.
Shelley, and to draw this back to the housing issue, when we hear these arguments from local communities about what building new housing does to the school district, do you have a position on whether or not it is this overwhelming burden, at least here in Westchester, or whether the two can be compatible?
I think clearly the two can be compatible. I mean, we must build, my focus is affordability, as you know, affordable housing, which may result in more children in our school district. Good, then let's have the conversation and let's find a way to make it work. But sometimes there's just this intuitive response that we're against development because it's gonna cause increase in our school taxes without much data to support it. So I think, you know, you've had this very sort of reasonable approach, which is let's build housing, particularly affordable housing. Affordable rental housing is my issue. And then we are gonna have additional children. Good, because we have declining enrollment in a number of our school districts, and we have to find a way to deal with it.
Thank you. So to take a step back and think about this issue more generally, I mean, our members rely on staff and I to talk about the specifics, but the general issue remains that the lack of housing is creating problems for the future health of the state economy, certainly here in Westchester. And that it's not just an affordability issue, it also touches upon demographics, community building, and workforce. It's also an issue that's been well studied for quite a while. We have a state where one party controls the levers of power in Albany, the Senate, the Assembly, and the State House. Considering that one party is in control of all of these levers, that this issue is a big issue, and it's been studied for years, why can't we get something done? Anybody want to address that? Maybe Chris
and Dan.
So maybe you want to step up the conversation.
Sure. I mean, I do think it has a lot to do with tenant protections. I think that that's something that is obviously scary to developers and to those in real estate, and even to a certain extent to small property owners that own, you know, small amounts of rental properties. But I do think that that's been a sticking point that sort of held us back, at least last year. We know we also got a lot of pushback. Hello, and everybody, I didn't say hello and well. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk to you all today. That we did get a lot of pushback locally in Westchester County, and we know in Long Island as well, there was a lot of pushback about the way that the governor had put forth the housing compact. So Assemblyman Burdick and I actually listened to that feedback and took it and put together a housing summit in October, I think it was. We brought in the Regional Plan Association, RPA. We had Pace Land Use Law Center there, and we also brought in a lot of the groups from Welcome Home Westchester, stakeholders in our districts, to really sort of dig into the details and look for common ground. And there actually is a lot of common ground, we believe, and Welcome Home Westchester did put together a summary of that for us to help us and guide us. And we also look to see what some of our neighboring states are doing that are producing much more housing. I think New Jersey produced like 500,000 units in the last 20 years to our negligible amount. So, what is it that we could really do? So the two of us are actually working together on a package of housing bills that we think will give appropriate amount of control to local municipal governments, but also hold everyone's feet to the fire that we know we have a housing crisis in the state. It's not just in the cities, and the cities don't need to be the only entities that are responsible for solving this crisis. In fact, we think it can be greatly helped by spreading and sharing the love around the state. Interestingly, yesterday at the budget hearing on education, I asked a question to teachers about housing, just because they were talking a little bit about congestion pricing, and UFT president Michael Mulgrew said it was the number one issue that popped in their survey as the most concern for teachers. So we're talking about education, and we're looking at it from a larger perspective. We know that teachers need housing that they can afford it. And he also said, we're not just talking about affordable housing in the way that we define it. We need multiple levels of housing that people can afford at their different income levels. So that's, again, something that we're both working on. Chris wants to talk a little bit, but I'll just throw out that, you know, we think together with the four bills that we're working on right now. And Chris, do you want me to question?
Chris, before we get to the specifics, Dana, yeah. Follow-up question. I'll put on my John McLaughlin hat. On a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being absolutely not and 10 being metaphysical certitude, is this the year that something gets done on housing?
Absolutely, yes. I think it's definitely something's going to get done on housing.
Okay, so Gary, as Dana's speaking,
something.
He's whispering in my ear and he's saying, you don't want to hear what I have to say.
Yeah, okay.
So it's like the big red button that says, don't push here. So I'm going to push the big red button, Gary, and ask you what your opinion is on this.
Well, when Dana says something will happen, yes, something will happen, and that something is nothing.
Obviously, I'm a little newer than Gary. I'm happier.
In my opinion, we don't have a housing shortage. We have an affordability shortage. People can't afford to live in many areas of this state, not just Westchester, New York City. I'm going to take a quick poll. By a show of hands, how many in this audience own a home, condo, co-op? Just raise your hand. And how many, leave your hands up. And how many of you, if you had to sell your home, co-op, or condo tomorrow, would sell it for the same thing you bought it for, less, or maybe 5% more? Leave your hand up. So there's one person. That's our problem.
You live in Larchmont. You're going to sell your house for 5%?
See, that is our problem.
You're probably in a flood zone or something.
Like, take it. Yep.
There is a buyout program.
Now, Speaker, don't jump in ahead to the flood issues. We'll get to those.
So this is what's causing the housing quote-unquote shortage in Westchester. None of us would sell our houses or our boats for less than what we paid for them. That number that we're looking for supersedes the income increases that when we bought our houses, which means that we are making our own homes unaffordable because housing prices are rising higher than inflation actually. We can't build because it costs a lot to build something. I know there are builders out here, and another show of hands. How many of you want me to raise your taxes to build housing? It's 1, 2, 4, okay. 5 people. When you do what's called a subsidy, that means the state or the federal government, whoever, gives a tax break to the builder. And that tax break has to be made up somewhere. It's made up by other taxpayers. So if Mr. Weiss builds a building and he gets a tax break and he saves $100,000 in sales taxes, that $100,000 has to be made up by Mr. Spano. And you know, we have everybody in here. So we don't want to do that. And that in this whole group, 2 people said they would pay more taxes for housing, but the rest of you said no. So when we're talking about a problem, we're also admitting to each other that we are the problem, we are part of the problem. So what we're gonna have to do is somehow, I can't recognize hands, because let me answer my last question. Unless we're willing to really bite the bullet and increase taxes substantially to build, we're going to have this problem for a long time. Last year, the governor made a proposal for auxiliary housing, and that really sounds good, but in my experience, I just use Mount Vernon as an example. I know you're all familiar with Mount Vernon. There are several really large, nice houses in Mount Vernon, and they were built for usually very large families. What's happened over time is that the families have been decreasing, the owners are aging, and they're renting out rooms. Now that sounds great, we're renting out a room, but the services being provided in that house are made for one family. That's when, you know, one person cooked for six people. When you take that same house and you put five extra people, that's five hot plates going. Five hot plates overloads the electrical system, and guess what burns down? The house. Now you have six people that are homeless. So that's also increasing, you know, the housing problem. So yes, there's a problem. Yes, it's serious. It can be addressed. I really don't think we'll be addressed this year because we're $4 billion in the hole, and we have other issues that we have to take care of. So anyway, I'm rambling on.
I know others want to weigh in. Natalia and Steve, if you want to step up.
Thank you for that, Gary. That was so uplifting. Jokes aside. Well, thank you for this topic. I'm the newest member of the Westchester delegation and the unicorn at this table that represents the Bronx and Westchester. So a lot of what we're talking in the budget, I got to weigh in how it affects upstate versus the unique boroughs of New York City. And the different, you know, governmental operations there. So when it comes to housing, I really try to think of everybody involved. And in New York City, it can be very heavy to the landlord versus tenant battle, and what side are you on, and who are you fighting for? And ultimately, all of us know we have to think about everybody in the equation, because whatever we do, we're not trying to hurt or to run you dry or to get you evicted or anything like that. So that balance is really important. And that's why I think it's taking this long to find what is that magic compromise when it comes to housing. I absolutely do believe we have to build. Now representing Westchester, I have Pelham and parts of New Rochelle. And New Rochelle, big ups to Nome and the leaders before me, because coming into now representing this district, one of the first things I noticed was the beautiful buildings in downtown New Rochelle. And in hearing more about it, who's there, what type of housing it is, the numbers shown that increasing the housing stock did indeed lower rent averages. So I think that's an example that we can utilize and look at in other places of the states, that increased supply, demand will go down, and the rents can go, can level out. But I'm stuck on figuring out and addressing why the rents are so high. When it comes to property taxes, I know New York City is a mess, and this whole state should be looking at the property tax system, why some communities are paying more than others. Looking at the other cost of property, specifically insurance premiums, that's a big issue that's come to my attention this last year as to how much insurance companies are now charging for premiums, forcing you to accept it because there's no other insurance program right now. I think it's only like three in the area for what I've been told. And it's increasing rents almost 300%. And tenants can't fight it because it's justified that the insurance company needs this much because they're deeming certain communities around it more liable for anything. And those communities they happen to be low-income communities. So there's a lot of problems with everything else around why the rent is what it is. And we have to address it, because if not, then even if we pass great things that, we'll only cap your rent at this percentage, well, if it's tied to inflation and everything else keeps going up, then that's not gonna help you in the long run, because rent will still go up, and if we can't afford it, then we're SOL.
Okay, we have a lot more to cover, but some quick hints before we move on to other topics from Steve. And then
I'm sorry to end it on SOL, but I'm very optimistic that, that we will get something done this year. We know it's dire, and we're
so
all committed
to it. On my 1 to 10 scale.
Yes.
We're going to get something done as a 10. We're definitely not going to get something done as a 1. What do you think?
Well, I think that scale depends on what you want to see in there.
Okay.
But based on everything...
Okay.
No. I'm going to say 7. Lucky number 7. Because we're going to get far enough in all the discussions that we've had. But is everything going to come through again for what everybody in the state wants? I don't know. But I do think we're going to get a good amount there to completing a lot of the goals that we have in 4.
Steve, and then back to Chris.
So the question at the beginning was... with Democrats controlling both houses of the legislature and the governor, why have we not had a resolution? And one should understand that in both houses, there are competing goals and interests among members on the housing issue. We did not renew 421A in New York City, primarily because there are many members that felt that that was not geared enough towards affordable housing, and they want to see changes, so nothing happened. We did not pass a variety of other things because resistance in terms of overriding local zoning, which is something that Tim Foley sort of fought against, but we're going to be meeting with the municipal officials later, and one of the messages we're going to send to them is you don't want an override of local zoning, you have to show that you're going to say yes to housing on your own. And I think we're going to put some of the burden on them.
So last year they got kind of a reprieve when the housing compact collapsed, and now you're putting the onus, you're saying, okay, you got what you wanted, now step up.
But I will tell you, that is absolutely the conversation I have with local officials. Show us that you're going to do something. On the other hand, there is a barrier in terms of affordable, not just in Westchester, but in the whole Northeast. Since COVID, I don't have to tell this audience, real estate prices have risen. So if you're going to ask a developer to create affordable housing, and you have to pay the market price for the land, the metrics of that are very difficult. One thing that I advocate for is state assistance, or the counties, Westchester County has done this for many years, which is free land to developers as an incentive for a portion of that being affordable, or all of that being affordable. I used to be a mayor, and we approved some affordable housing projects in my community, the land was for free, and so the economics for the developer made that work, and that it's been, even in my assembly district, that has happened. New Rochelle has done a great thing, because New Rochelle is actually, with all the development, it's one of the places where they've actually, in some projects, exceeded the 10% through some creative work by the New Rochelle government and staff, but in a lot of Westchester, more supply has not necessarily meant lower prices in housing. In some places, I represent Portchester, more supply is actually added to gentrification and lessening the more affordable piece.
You're not going to tell me that's why Bronxville doesn't want to build, is it?
So I'll throw one other thing in, which is, and I go to meetings in my district. I was in a meeting in New Rochelle over the summer, where there was an affordable housing development, and the developer was there to describe what the units were, and there's an affordable portion, but the affordable portion was hitting a very high AMI. And so a lot of the people in the audience says, that's really upper middle class housing, that's not affordable housing. So back to my original point, which is there are many competing interests and concerns and priorities of members of both the Senate and the Assembly, and it's not just like an automatic, everyone gets on the same page. People want to see these different challenges addressed in a comprehensive housing plan. One thing we didn't do last year, we should have done, even though we couldn't get an agreement on the governor's housing compact, we should have kept in an increased amount of money, state money, to support affordable housing, and that was pulled out of the budget. That was a mistake, because we need those dollars to help support and subsidize the kind of work that developers are doing.
Okay, before I move to healthcare, I know that Chris is working on this issue, so I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the leadership that WCA has had on this and the allies with WCA, because it helps to push the conversation. As Dana was mentioning, we are partnering on a package of housing bills. I have a bill that I just introduced that would require every municipality to do a needs assessment across all income levels so that they can have an idea of what needs to be done. A second bill in the package is to require every locality to determine whether it's in the public interest to update their town comprehensive plan, village comprehensive plan, etc. Doesn't require them to do it, but they have to look at it. Then Dina has a bill that will be introduced soon that will work off of this, which is every municipality has to adopt a housing action plan. What's different from last year is it isn't telling them what you must do, how many you have to build, where you have to build it, and so forth, but you must come up with something. Another bill that she has is one that's climate informative and transit oriented informative. And this actually segues with what the governor has proposed in her budget, which I consider to be very positive, which is to really look at repurposing land, making sure that transit areas and other state and other government-owned lands may be made available to development. I actually am optimistic about this. I think that a lot of it can be done through the marketplace. As an example of that, Lewisburg Commons, which is in my district, was put together because they're taking advantage of federal affordable tax credits. That's the market working. Now, what we have to do is we have to partner with developers that are willing to step up to the plate. And also in Lewisboro, they're looking at some a commuter parking lot that's underutilized. Again, because the governor is pushing this, we could get people to come to the table that 5-6 years ago would not. Whether it's the MTA or the DOT, we're talking to each other. I think that things can be done, more to come. And thank you for your advocacy to push this matter.
All right, Matt, 30 seconds.
30 seconds. It's always great to be able to say I agree with my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, and not on everything they said, but on most of it. But the one thing I didn't hear was resetting the rent stabilization rates, because there are tens of thousands of vacant units in New York City right now that the landowners or the property owners have to invest in to bring them up to code. So the economics just don't work out for them. And Kenny Burgos, a Democrat from the Bronx, has a bill that I'm proud to co-sponsor that would reset those rent stabilization rates so they can actually reinvest in their properties, bring them up to code, and finally fill them. Last I heard, it was about 50,000 units in the New York City boroughs that this could apply to. And if you want to talk about restocking the housing supply, that's an easy first step that the legislature can take.
30 seconds. So Amy is not here this morning. So the 45 minutes we could have spent on healthcare, we can distill into probably 5 or 10 minutes. She did graciously sit with the members of our healthcare community back in November, and we thank her for that. But I put it to the panel. There's no money, I understand that, budget deficit. On the other hand, we have this incredible funding gap that our hospitals face and our healthcare providers on Medicaid, 30% or more. There's no money, we need money, something has to give. Last year, this delegation did push the governor to find money to increase Medicaid reimbursement by some amount. Can we expect the same kind of support this year for pushing for a little bit more funding for Medicaid reimbursement from this panel?
Absolutely. Our healthcare system is not doing everything it can do because our Medicare rates are just abysmal. So I know I've been vocal, many of us have been vocal, signing on to the letter, but we desperately want to see, and I speak for me and everyone, we want to see an increase.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thumbs up? Okay.
Yeah, and say just thumbs up.
Yeah, I was gonna say, just as we talked about, and all of these issues that we're talking about are really old issues, whether it was funding for education, whether it's the abysmal Medicaid reimbursement rates. So we have been incrementally and forcefully really trying to address these long-standing neglected problems. And I know it's hard because you're trying to correct the past and you're in the present and the costs continue to go upward. But I think every single one of us, and everyone, frankly, across the state, understand that we need to make sure our healthcare system is working. We need to make sure our hospitals have the resources they need. We need to make sure that we are reimbursing the hospitals for the work that they do. And we understand nursing home issues. We know that it's all a huge thing. So we continue. We promise we will continue to push to make sure that we are meeting the needs now and in the future.
Okay, so we're going to say a 30% increase, right, guys?
I don't think anybody has to raise your hand. You think you're going to get a 30% increase of this year? Okay.
Not even Lisa raised her hand. She's got a.
Not even the one person.
So
we'll take it.
So there is actually some low-hanging fruit, stuff that doesn't require you to reach into the budget, and things that would save our hospitals and providers some money. There are some COVID rules that are still in place, things like COVID pay and data related to certain HRDS reporting requirements that are still in place. And I'm wondering from the panel, have we moved beyond these requirements, and can they be lifted in the budget this year? This to me doesn't look like a big lift. I'm just wondering if there's agreement on the panel.
I hope so. I think so, yes. Mm-hmm.
I would hope so.
Workforce practice, scope of practice, interstate coordination, some bills out there, the Interstate Medical Compact, and again, scope of practice. Do you support these measures? And if not, why not? Everybody supports these measures? Okay, so we're going to have some.
I have to say some. I can't support every scope of practice bill because I don't know what ones you're referring
got
to.
It.
But there are some that are supportable, some are unbelievable.
And I just say generically, scope of practice issues are become complicated and they're on a case-by-case basis to analyze, and lots of people feed into that process, and it's one of those things where the legislature hears from both sides and year to year makes a judgment, and so there's general,
there's a general appetite for liberalizing these rules.
Sometimes, but there's scrutiny case by case on something like that and many things, and that's probably a wise way to proceed.
And what about the interstate compacts? Those are, clear pieces of legislation out there in their current form.
Yes.
Are there something that you guys can support?
Well, again, it's going to be a case by case judgment on those.
I think that's right. There was a hearing in December in New York City, and this was thrashed out quite a bit. I think that there's some appetite to look at it, but it's very tricky. These interstate compacts are very tricky. You can't decide that you're either all in or you're not in at all. And I think, though, that there will be some examination of the licensing requirements to see if something can be done to liberalize them.
And also just to add, I think that if there is a compact, that there should be like issues. Just for an example, New York State requires a registered nurse to have a bachelor's degree. Massachusetts requires an associate's degree. Why would we want to compact with Massachusetts when theoretically, the education that their nurses has is less than the ones that we have.
These things get complicated because I think there was a case in Florida where they were, it was pay for a diploma kind of thing, pay for licensing, and we can't have that, obviously. So I think when you have, it's just like everything else, when you have extremes that raise the ire and the danger of the situation, people are a little less reluctant to just embrace everybody who says, I have a license. So I think there's an appetite to try and make something make sense, but that's kind of been the issue, that everybody's license is a license, and we don't want to degrade the services that we have, here in our great state.
I'm going to move to climate change. And Pete Harkin is here. He's traveling for his daughter's wedding. I didn't get the invite. Must have been lost in the mail. But I'll keep it pretty general, because I know that that's Pete's bailiwick, and other folks might be generalists on the panel. But last year saw passage of the All-Electric Buildings Act, which restricted fossil fuel hookups for newly constructed buildings and facilities. There was other legislation dealing with existing buildings and having to retrofit them and convert to electric. Given the current environment, I didn't see that. I didn't see anything on that in the executive budget. So I think there's been a little bit of a retreat. Last year it was in the budget. This year it's not. But is there anyone on the panel who thinks we can aggressively move towards converting existing buildings? And for the record, the WCA is not in favor of that unless there's funding attached to it because of the incredible expense associated with going to electric, particularly in a county like Westchester where the cost could actually eclipse the value of the asset. So I'm wondering if anybody wants to weigh in on the conversion of existing buildings to electric at this point.
Now, electricity sounds good, but my question is, where do we get it? I think one of the biggest mistakes that we made was shutting down Indian Point that produced a large amount of electricity. If you look, we're requiring school districts now to have electric buses. People are buying electric cars. There's no place to plug them in. I just don't know where this extra electricity is going to come from to power these new homes. And the conversion is really expensive. You convert from gas or oil to electric. That's an expensive proposition, which leads back to the affordability, because when you have your house converted, you sell it, you can sell it for a lot more than. Anyway, old question.
I have to say that I went to a very interesting panel discussion last week up in Albany that Anir Kligo Conservation Motors hosted, and it was all about adopting the clean fuel standard, which is something that California did, and it was amazing that the people at the table included an agriculture person, Delta Airlines, and really looking into the way that you can make biodiesel and clean fuels and zero emission fuels part of the conversation. I was interested in it because they were really looking at the whole picture, not just not just the fuel itself and like just replacing it, but looking at the whole picture from a perspective of decarbonization and zero emissions and how it would have an impact on the land and how it would have, all those sorts of things. And it was a really positive conversation, something that California did, I think, 10 or 20 years ago. And they're in a much better place now than we are because they adopted this. And so I think it's something that we should be thinking about, talking about, certainly as a transition. I know that it's complicated with CLCPA, but I do think that we're going to have to figure out path forward.
So that leads to a really interesting question. We all agree that this is hard stuff. There's math involved. But the law was passed by the legislature. It was signed by the governor. Without really a fulsome understanding of the path goals. Now I know that the work of the Climate Action Council, they put out their plan. I'm wondering if anybody has any thoughts about the law itself and the goals that are included in the law, or whether or not at some point that they have to be revisited.
Well, I'm going to answer it in a different way. There are many tools out there to do these transitions, not as a mandate, but because there are technologies. So for instance, there is a neighborhood in Chelsea in Manhattan, obviously an urban area, and they are taking this neighborhood and they're converting to geothermal. They have experts that go in there and do this, and so these transitions are actually happening, maybe a little under the radar. There's an effort being made to have our SUNY campuses move to clean energy. Geothermal is another way of converting. The all-electric for new buildings is different than you asked your question about transition to existing buildings. And so that's going to happen somewhat on an ad hoc basis, but there is a lot of federal money to drive this. There's also, we have a lot of census tracts in Westchester are economic justice census tracts where there is higher air pollution issues. And so there's gonna be more federal money directed to those to convert some of those buildings, maybe to geothermal, other kinds of transition. So is it all gonna happen at the drop of a dime? Absolutely not. But we're going to need to find ways to clean up how we produce and consume energy, because we are also suffering from the impacts of more severe storms. We see tremendous monetary damage, loss of life because of flooding. These things are not unrelated. If you look on the East Coast, our shorelines are disappearing. We are losing shorelines because of sea level rise. So the idea that we're gonna like say this isn't a real thing is not really the real thing.
There's no room here for climate deniers. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so the short answer is we don't need mandates, but there is generous federal money to make some of these things happen. And so geothermal is one of the things that can be done in office parks. As I say, SUNY is moving to do this in a lot of their campuses. Also, OGS is working to try and move that conversion to state office buildings around the state. So those examples actually are going to drive the private sector as well. When government is doing government properties, they're going to look for opportunities. We've asked OGS and NYSERDA to share their expertise in Westchester. NYPA has been meeting with school districts and trying to give them tools on how they could do, with state help, conversions to solar or geothermal in school buildings.
So anyways, it all comes back to what Gary says. Where is this power going to come from? The last couple of months have seen a couple of big projects, the offshore wind, basically taking a retreat because of the cost overruns and the need to negotiate with the state. So it's not going great. You know, we have to get to a certain point by 2030 by legal fiat, and then we have to get even further 20 years after that, and we are a little behind.
But we're going to have next week in Albany the budget hearing that's going to have NYSERDA and NYPA testify, DEC testify, and so I think we will get an update on where they think they are going. Actually, last year's projections were that we are sort of moving in the direction to meet most of our statewide targets. So it's not all doom and gloom. It's not all going to happen, as I say, immediately. But there is tremendous federal money to help fund these technologies. We need to be doing something, and I've spoken to the Thruway Authority about it, more solar on the sides of the thruway. If you go to other states, you see a lot of solar farms. They're not taking up farmland, they're next to highways, and that's a way to do this. I'd also say the Thruway Authority is expanding and has an ability to expand further EV charging. There was an article in the New York Times a few weeks ago saying that EV sales are moderating because of fear that there's not enough charging infrastructure out there. The state government needs to do a better job of getting that charging infrastructure out there, because the EV vehicles are popular, but they're not popular if you can't charge and don't feel you can drive from point A to point B, beyond your local driving easily. So it's all a work in progress. We got to stay at it because we're all going to be underwater otherwise.
Look, I would posit that the big issues, the big stuff, is the big supply stuff. The EV stuff, we need all that at the end of the value chain, but really it's the focus on the supply stuff. And I was talking to Noam before I came up here. Politics drives policy, policy drives progress. So maybe we're not sure how we're going to get there.
More renewables, and they are happening.
So there's a lot we're not going to
do. And by the way, we love those solar canopies being built out there. Look how great those are. Everybody wants to park under them.
How about a round of applause for Mr. Weiss? He's got some in back, too. So we're not going to get to everything, obviously. In the interest of time, we didn't get to digital, we didn't get to infrastructure, we didn't get to cap and invest, we didn't get to budget deficits going on down to the horizon and how we deal with those. But I guess I should end with, before I turn it over to Leader Cousins for some closing remarks, with the Super Bowl picks. So, the Super Bowl.
Now, I'm...
How can a politician talk for 20 minutes on Super Bowl picks?
My wife is from Buffalo. We are heartbroken that the Bills did not make
okay,
it.
Okay, Natalia, so what's your Super Bowl pick?
Team Taylor.
Okay. Steve, want to make a pick?
I'm just good eating chicken wings and beef on Wednesday.
Okay. Leader Cousins, you have a Super Bowl pick?
Came to my mind the Chiefs.
The Chiefs. Gary?
I have to be NFL, so whoever is it, not the American Football League, the National Football League, instead of San Francisco.
Chiefs by three.
By three?
Okay.
Chiefs by three.
What's the over? I don't know. I sure don't gamble,
so I you? You?
San Francisco.
San Francisco. I think the die had it right. I think Taylor Swift's already won the Super Bowl.
It's all right.
Leader
Cousins. Wait a minute, please. We're having girls' night after.
You don't know what she just said. She said because it's all planned. I'm sure you all have heard about the conspiracy theory that is somehow driving the Super Bowl and the fixing of the Super Bowl on behalf of Taylor and her manufactured relationship. I think that's probably a good way to end this. While we are still on Team Earth, we are in Planet Westchester, and we couldn't be happier with the insight, the interest, the advocacy, the friendship, the relationships that we have built over these years. And certainly as we in the Westchester delegation have ascended into very key policy-making positions. I hope that you will know that none of us takes this for granted, that none of us assumes that we are the great oracles that know everything because we now have titles of chair or leader or whatever. We know that we depend on those who are working in the vineyard every day to help inform our decisions. And so we take your input seriously as well. I do believe that, you know, things will continue to happen in the housing space because, as you said, there are a lot of competing interests, but the one central interest is creating housing. So as long as we collectively continue to make that push forward, again, an old problem that has been allowed to not really be addressed. I always talk about Mitchell Lama in 1955. They figured out a housing program that everybody got together and pushed forward. We haven't figured out anything. And I don't believe that we're any less capable of figuring out something than colleagues back in 1955, nor do I believe the need is diminished. So we are focused on that. You asked about climate change. We are where we are. We are, all of us, dealing with climate events that we never thought that we would ever have to deal with. And again, you know, denial of that has brought us to this place. So we continue to move forward. We've allowed our NYPA, our public, to do renewables, to build renewables, to figure out ways to build renewables. And again, in every way, we will continue to push this ball forward. But again, we won't do it without you. I want to thank my colleagues in the Assembly, the Senate, a lot more Assembly people than senators, as you can see, but we are the upper house, so we don't mind the fact that there are fewer, but regardless of the numbers, this number collectively is supporting what's best, again, for our county, which I believe is best for our state. So again, thanks WCA, thank all of you for sharing the morning. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.